gracious and eternal God, we give you thanks that you have set us free, and whom the Son hath set free is free indeed. Minister to us in our freedom, that our minds may be renewed as free people to make the right choices, think the right thoughts, speak the right words, and love as you have called us to be loved by you through your Son, Jesus Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen. Give honor to God. It is good to be here with my friend, Pastor Gregory Jackson. I honor him as the pastor of this church. One of the reasons I call when Pastor Jackson, or I come when Pastor Jackson calls, is that every time he calls, it's not for me to come. I hope you figured that out. You know, some preachers just call because they want something. You know, Doc, I want you to come holler for me. And so they only call you when they want to use you. And then they give you a check and send you on your way. Now, in some neighborhoods, there's a word for that. And I don't want to be one of those. And your pastor doesn't treat me like that. And that's why when he does call and ask me to come to Mount Olive, I come. Because he's my friend. I don't have many friends. Neither do you. You don't have many friends. So I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be here because Mount Olive is just a great church. I've been coming here for years. In fact, even before I moved to Patterson in 1981, I used to sneak up here and have breakfast with Dr. Coleman and get preaching pointers. Because I was a young man that didn't know much about preaching, and he would sit me down at the diner and give me advice. And I'm still not as good as him. I talked to his daughter last week, and I said, I'm still not as good as your father. She said, that's right, you're not. So I'm just going to be me this morning. And Sister Coleman, it's always good to see you. Always good to see you. That's hard for me to believe that... The first time I was in this church, I was 1978. I don't look that old, do I? Beware of lightning. I want to call our attentions on this day to 2 Samuel chapter 9, where David the king shows kindness to a man named Mephibosheth. David the king shows kindness to a man named Mephibosheth. And permit me, if you would, to read the entire chapter, because the entire chapter is relevant for us on this family strengthening weekend. Now David said, "Is there still anyone who is left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" There was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba. So when they had called him to David, the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" He said, "At your service." Then the king said, "Is there not still someone of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God?" And Ziba said to the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan who is lame in his feet." So the king said to him, "Where is he?" Ziba said to the king, "Indeed, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, in Lodibar." Then King David sent and brought him out of the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, from Lodibar. Now when Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, had come to David, he fell on his face and prostrated himself. Then David said, "Mephibosheth?" And he answered, "Here is your servant." So David said to him, "Do not fear, for I will surely show you kindness for Jonathan your father's sake, and will restore to you all the land of Saul your grandfather, and you shall eat bread at my table continually." Then he bowed himself and said, "What is your servant that you should look upon such a dead dog as I?" And the king called to Ziba, Saul's servant, said to him, "I have given to your master's son all that belonged to Saul and to his house. You therefore and your sons and your servants shall work the land for him, and you shall bring in the harvest that your master's son may have food to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's son, shall eat bread at my table always." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king has commanded his servant, so will your servant do. As for Mephibosheth," said the king, "he shall eat at my table like one of the king's sons." Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah, and all who dwelt in the house of Ziba were servants of Mephibosheth. So Mephibosheth dwelt in Jerusalem, for he ate continually at the king's table, and he was lame in both his feet. Verse 7, "So David said to him," Mephibosheth, "do not fear, for I will surely show you kindness for Jonathan, your father's sake, and will restore to you all the land of Saul, your grandfather, and you shall eat bread at my table continually." Guess who's coming to dinner? Guess who's coming to dinner? Ziba woke up this particular morning, most likely with no memory of Mephibosheth. Though Ziba had been part of the same household as Mephibosheth, there was no real reason for him to think back to the days when he and Mephibosheth were in the same household. Mephibosheth's father, Jonathan, had been killed. Mephibosheth's grandfather, Ziba's employer, King Saul, had been killed. The family had been dispersed, and Ziba moved on. You know, there are times when folks just move on. Negative things had happened, but now it was time to go in a different direction, and Ziba latched on with King David and became part of David's household. No reason to think back to Jonathan. No reason to think back to Saul. No reason to think back to Mephibosheth. And so he awakened on this particular day, going about his normal duties with Mephibosheth the farthest thing perhaps from his mind. It's interesting that there are people that you can grow up with, people that can be in the same household as you, but then things happened and you put them out of your mind. You lived under the same roof at one point, but something happens like an arrest. Something happens like a trial. Something happens like a conviction, and now you've put them out of your mind. Mephibosheth was living in a place called Lodibar, an awful place, a place whose name literally meant without pasture, no green, no word, nothing good about Lodibar. And it's interesting because later King David asks about Mephibosheth, and Ziba knows where he is, but he really doesn't have Mephibosheth on his mind. Isn't that interesting? You can know where somebody is. You can know that where they are is a horrible place. You can know that where they are is a place of pain and isolation. And that somebody can be someone that you used to live under the same room with, under the same roof with. But you can put them far out of your mind. One of the things that makes prisons so difficult is that there are people who live in those prisons, men and women, who grew up in the same household with us, grew up under the same roof as us, but then something happened. They got arrested, they got tried, they got convicted, they got put behind bars, and now we've put them out of our mind. We know where they are. We know the name of the jail. We know the name of the prison. But we've put that behind us now. And now they live as if no one remembers. I can speak from experience. Because despite the nice introduction your pastor gave me, one of the things that I always make sure I acknowledge as part of my bio is my inmate number, 10002648 George W. Hill Correctional Facility. Because I can remember as an inmate that there were times when you feel as though people who grew up with you, people who came up with you, people who were under the same roof as you can put you out of mind. Most inmates don't get visits because they've been put out of our minds. And female inmates get even less visits than male inmates do. That may sound surprising, but you see, here's how it works. Bro gets locked up, and the woman will still come to see him. Sis gets locked up, and bro says, next. Locked up in Lodibar, in dangerous conditions and out of sight, out of mind. But one of the beautiful things about this story is that even when folks from your household may have forgotten about you, the king does not. I'm glad today that though Ziba had put Mephibosheth out of mind, the king, King David, representing the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. The king says, something is bothering me. Is there anyone left from the household of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake? And all of a sudden, Ziba's memory is jarred. And he says, oh, yes, there is somebody from that household. There is somebody. His name is Mephibosheth, and he lives in Lodibar. Isn't it interesting how something can show up and jog our memory? Even those memories we try to suppress, even those memories we try to put down. I used to teach a course at Howard called Prison Ministry. Nobody would take my class. And so I went to the dean. I said, Dean, no one will take my prison ministry class. He said, well, I guess nobody's really interested in that stuff. And so I went back to my office and I thought and I came up with an idea. I went to the dean. I said, Dean, our ethicist is on leave this semester, right? He said, yes. I said, can I teach the ethics course? He said, sure, you can teach the ethics course. So I took my prison ministry syllabus. And I erased prison ministry. And I wrote ethics. Third week of class, one of my students came up and got in my face. You tricked us. I said, yeah. She said, if I had known this was course talking about prisoners, I never would have taken it. I said, I know. That's why I had to do this. I'm going to report you to the dean. I'm going to report you to the president. She went off on me. Would you ever get someone just right up in your face? You could feel the breath and the spit. The next week, she came up to me. She apologized. She said, I have to apologize to you. She did it in front of the class. She said, I apologize to you. She said, I was so angry, and I had to go back and ask God why I was so angry. She said, and the Lord told me because your brother's been locked up for 12 years and you've never gone to see him. And you're feeling so guilty over that, that this course is forcing you to deal with the fact that you have it in your family. I can happily report that today not only does she visit her brother, but she has done research and begun praying over her family because there's so many people in her family that have been convicted of crimes and that the family is now trying to reconnect. Sometimes all it takes is the king saying, is there anyone left in the household of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake? And all of a sudden, Ziba remembers there's Mephibosheth. We used to be under the same roof. We used to be part of the same household. There's Mephibosheth, but he lives in Lodibar. Now, can we shift for a moment? We've looked at this from Ziba's perspective, and But look at it from Mephibosheth's perspective. Because Mephibosheth is struggling in Lodibar. He has a really low image of who he is. And the reason we know that is that later in the text, he refers to himself as a dead dog. He has internalized what everybody else has said about him. They've all said he's useless. They've all said he's no good. And now he begins to believe that about himself. Dead dog. He internalized the negativity from the outside, and it now has become part of his persona. Maybe like some of the inmates that don't think that they're worth anything. I mean, after all, Mephibosheth had it hard. He didn't start off bad. Didn't start off headed for jail. In fact, our jails and prisons are filled with people for whom there were great expectations. When Mephibosheth was born, his father was a prince and his grandfather was the king. And so they had a party at the palace. They said, one day Mephibosheth is going to be king. They had all kinds of hopes and dreams, just like this family does for Jordan. Every inmate, when he was born, somebody had great hopes. But how many of you know that there's often a gap between the expectation and the experience? And if you don't believe that there's a gap between expectation and experience, ask someone who's married. There are things that happen in life that create a great chasm between expectation and experience. Everything was looking up for Mephibosheth. He was going to become the king one day, and then something happened, and the war broke out, and when the war broke out, his father Jonathan was killed. At the age of 5, Mephibosheth lost his father. The first problem he had was his father wasn't around to raise him. Father absence plagued so many. Most of the men who are incarcerated grew up without their fathers in the household. And one of the things that we know for those men who are incarcerated, whose fathers are still alive, one of the things we know is that the single most important person to visit an inmate that can help turn his life around and make things work when he comes home is the father. We've done the research on it. A father's visit means more than a mother's visit. A father's visit means more than a brother or a sister visit. A father's visit means more than a clergy visit. If you are a father and you have a son or even a daughter that's incarcerated, your presence means more than anybody else. It's like saying, Daddy's still here. I have not given up on you. I've talked to so many fathers. I talked to a couple yesterday, a couple preachers. I told my son that if he keeps messing up like that, he's going to get locked up. And if he does, I ain't going to see him. He got locked up, and I didn't go see him. And then in hindsight, it's the worst decision I ever made. If there's ever a time your son needs you, it's when they're incarcerated. If there's ever a time your son needs you, Dad, it's when he's in Lodibar. I know he let you down. I know he disappointed you. But if there's ever a time he needed to see Daddy's face and hear Daddy's voice, it's when he's in Lodibar. But Mephibosheth did not have the benefit of a father present because his father was taken off the scene. And then the second thing that happened to Mephibosheth was that the woman who was responsible to raise him dropped him. When the word came to the palace that Jonathan had been killed, Mephibosheth's nurse picked him up and tried to rush him and carry him out of the palace. And in her rush to take care of him, she dropped him. Do you know how many of us have been dropped by women who meant well, but in their rush to take care of us, they dropped us? You meant well, sis. Are you a single parent? You meant well, but you dropped us. See, here's the first mistake you made. You said, now, you're the little man, so you got to be the little man of the house. You said that. You got to be the little man of the house. Can I tell you something? He's 5. He's not ready to be the man of the house. You meant well, but you dropped him. Got to be a big boy now. Big boys don't cry. Boys cry. Men cry. See, y'all mess us up with that. I want a man in touch with his emotions. I want a man who's not afraid to cry. I want a man who knows how to experience life and he's in touch with himself. And then when your man starts crying, my man a punk. He's a... always crying, he a punk. I need me a real man. Because real men don't cry. Really? Real men don't cry? There was a real man who hung on a cross one day. And probably the first Bible verse you memorized said that he cried one day. Because if you didn't know any other Bible verse, especially if you grew up in one of those houses where you had to say a Bible verse in order to eat. You know that Jesus wept. So if real men don't cry, what are you saying about Jesus? You meant well, but you dropped him. I have to be the mother and the father because the father's not around. You're not equipped to be a mother and a father. You're equipped to be a mother. And if there's no man around, then all of these men here in the church ought to be stepping into the gap and providing the male leadership that sons of single mothers need, because no woman can be a mother and a father. You can't teach him how to be a man by example because you don't have the equipment to do that. And so it's time for men to step up and to be a presence in the life of boys who don't have a father figure. It's time for fathers, grandfathers and uncles and cousins and all of us who are male to step into the lives and show these young men how to be a presence. Because the women may mean well, but in their well-meaning, sometimes they drop us. And now we're in Lodibar. Zeba's not thinking about me. My father's not around. The woman who raised me dropped me. I don't have any hope except one day I was on the king's mind. Oh, it's a good thing when you're on the king's mind. When one out of nine black males between the ages of 20 and 34 are in state and federal prison. Did you get that number? One out of nine black males between the ages of 20 and 34 are in state prison. And that means that's not counting county jail. If I had county jail, probation, and parole, the numbers of black males between the ages of 20 and 34 that fit in that number are one in three. When the female prison population in the United States has gone up by 839% since 1977, and we have forgotten about black women behind bars because we are so focused on black men who we really don't think about that much anyway, and most of the black women that are behind bars are guilty of one crime and one crime only, and that's making a bad decision about a black man. Baby, you know I need protection. I need you to go get this piece for me down. Baby, I need you to make this purchase for me. I need you to move this product for me. Baby, I need you to make this phone call for me. More than 80% of all the women that are in jail or in prison are there because of a decision made surrounding a man. And when your family has forgotten about you, and when your friends have forgotten about you, and even the church has forgotten. You know, the church forgets about inmates. The church forgets about inmates. It's amazing. I talk to my students at Howard University, and they say, well, I'm not called to prison ministry. I can't deal with inmates. You can't deal with inmates. I said, can I have your Bible for a second? Why? I said, because we have to edit. You have to edit the Bible for anybody who doesn't want to be around inmates. They said, really? I said, yeah, first we have to take out the book of Genesis. Because Joseph was an inmate. Then we flip over to the prophets, and we have to take out the book of Jeremiah. Because Jeremiah was in solitary confinement until an African came along and organized a prison ministry and took 30 guys in to pull him out. Then we got to get rid of the book of Daniel, because Daniel was a two-time loser, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were on death row. Then we got to flip over to the New Testament. We got to do some more editing. We got to take out the book of Revelation, because that was written while John was in custody. Then we got to take out 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, because it's the same dude. Then we got to move over to 1st and 2nd Peter, because Peter was an inmate. Peter got arrested, got locked up. The church prayed for him all night long. God gave him early release. He came back to church, knocked at the door. They still wouldn't let him in, so stuff ain't changed. Not finished. Got to get rid of the book of Philippians. I know you said I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, but that was written by an inmate, and if you can't deal with inmates, you got to take that out the Bible. And now we got to get rid of the Gospels, because there's John the Baptist. He's an inmate. He's got to go. And then there was this one inmate who, when he was born, the angels sang. This one inmate who, when he was born, shepherds were watching their flocks and heard angels singing. Wise scholars from Persia came to see him when he was born. But when he said, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit, he was an inmate. I tell my Catholic friends, if you're ashamed of an inmate, why do you wear an inmate around your neck? But the shame and the stigma of incarceration such, Reverend, that's different. Those were good inmates. No. I get that. They say they didn't do anything wrong. They didn't do anything wrong. They were doing the right thing and got locked up. So, okay. All right. Suppose dude is walking down the street. Dude's walking down the street and he sees one of his boys in an argument with his boss. He's in an argument with the boss, and the boss starts wailing on dude. But friends, so dude jumps in the middle between the boss and starts wailing on the boss and accidentally kills the boss to get him off his boy. Oh, that's manslaughter. That's manslaughter. So he got to go to jail. Yep, he got to go to jail. Okay, you just put Moses in jail. Or this musician I was reading about. Seriously, I was reading about this musician, because you know musicians. Something about musicians. I can say that because I'm one. You know, musicians, we're temperamental. You know, we like having things our own way. And there was this one musician I was reading about. He was up in his penthouse one day, took the day off. And he looked over and he said, look at her. She's fine. I got to get with that. In fact, I'm going to write me a new song about her. The Lord is my shepherd. I see what I want. Yo, dog, who is that? Man, she got somebody. I ain't ask you that. Who is it? That's her name is Bathsheba, but she got somebody, dog. Look, man, I don't care if she got somebody. We can fix that. That's just a minor technicality. All we got to do is rearrange some stuff, and dude is off the picture, and I can tap that. Y'all going, ooh. But that's what it is. Man, that dude definitely got to arrest him. Okay. Now I'm trying to remember his name. David. See, today we call that conspiracy to commit murder. And in some states, that's a capital offense. Yet God said he's a man. After my own heart. Go back and check the record. Because the Bible says that when Nathan came to David several chapters later and he got in David's face, he didn't get on him about adultery. He got on him about abusing his power to commit murder. So I can't let the shame and the stigma of incarceration keep me from dealing with my family member. I can't let the shame and stigma of incarceration keep me from dealing with folks under who I grew up with under the same roof. I can't let the shame and stigma of incarceration drive me back, because if I can't deal with an inmate, I can't deal with Joseph, I can't deal with Jeremiah, I can't deal with Daniel, I can't deal with Shadrach, I can't deal with Meshach, I can't deal with Abednego, I can't deal with Peter, I can't deal with Paul, I can't deal with John, and I sure can't deal with Jesus. David says, come here, Mephibosheth, you're going to eat at my table. Now, this is interesting, because usually when somebody comes out of Lodibar, we got to get them a program, right? We have to have a reentry program. We have to teach them skills. And you can teach people programs. You can give people programs. You can give them jobs. You can give them housing. You can give them all kinds of programs. Programs are tremendous, but there's nothing like having a seat at the table. In fact, getting involved in a life of another individual and walking with them is sometimes, in fact, most of the time, more important than whether or not they actually get in the program. Because the two most important things when you come home from prison are not, do you have a job and a house? That's what the newspapers say. They say it all the time. They need jobs, they need housing. That's nice. I'm a sociologist. I have a PhD in sociology. I know how to count numbers. I know how to do analysis. Let me tell you something. Jobs and housing are number three and number four. Because according to the data, the two most important things when a person comes home is how they think and who their friends are. Antisocial thinking and antisocial companionship will take you right back to the joint. How do I know that? Figure this out. I get you a job. I get you a house, but you think the same old way and you hang out with the same old folks, what are you going to do? Go back to the same old place. And there's only one institution I know in American society that majors in how you think and who you hang with. There's only one institution in America that majors in changing people's thinkings and changing people's relationships. And that's not the job training program, and that's not the reentry program, and that's not the housing program. It's the Church of Jesus Christ. This is where you come to get your thinking changed and to get your friendships changed. Which really means that we, more than any other institution in American society, have the power to stem mass incarceration, because we can change how people think and we can change how people hang with if we remember that they exist. David said, you will have a seat at my table. David said that when I sit down to eat, you'll be right there with me. David said when all that has been taken from you is going to be restored to you, and you're going to be a member of the royal family. See, it's not just a matter of getting people back on their feet when they get out. It's a matter of getting them reintegrated. And that requires spending time with them. That's what the dinner table is all about. That requires getting to know them all over again. That requires being able to be present for them, rejecting the shame and the stigma. Somebody who lets you know that you are forgiven. You are welcome back. One of the churches we work with in Detroit, a young man had been away for 17 years. And when he got out on a murder charge, the church had been so supportive of him that he said to his sister, take me to your church. I want to see these people that have been supporting me and praying for me all these years. And when he got to the church, he looked at the door, and at the door was the usher. And you know, Baptist ushers are interesting people. Not at Mount Olive. Y'all settled that. But you know, there are other churches. My kids, when they were growing up, they wouldn't come to my church. Their mother's Episcopalian. They go to the Episcopal church because the Episcopal ushers are nice. They shake your hand, they got little flowers, and they smile, they're glad you're here, give you a program. Baptists, they said, Dad, we don't come to your church because your Baptist ushers are mean. We come, they said, can't come in yet. Back
You know, not all of y'all don't have that problem. But in my church, the Baptist up against the door. And then when they finally open the door, it's like the police, you know. So we go to mom's church because they're nicer. And I used to tell that story a lot when I would do my prison ministry talk. And then I heard about what happened when this young man saw this usher, because when he looked at this Baptist usher at the back of the door, he recognized her. She was the sister of the guy he killed 17 years ago. His mouth dropped open, but she took one look at him and said, "Don't be afraid. I know who you are. And I forgave you a long time ago, because I didn't want unforgiveness to rule my life. And so I forgive you for killing my brother. I've wanted to come down to the jail, to the prison, and tell you that, but the Department of Corrections wouldn't let me. But now that I see you face to face, I can say to you in person, welcome to our church. You are forgiven." They had church that Sunday. And given what you and I have done, is it inconceivable that the same God who forgave us, is it inconceivable that he could give us the same power and ability to forgive someone else? Isn't it believable that the God who forgives us, and now we say he lives inside me, he walks with me and talks with something in the inside, working on the outside. Isn't it conceivable that the God who's on the inside of us can give us the capacity to offer the same forgiveness to others and become part of their process of restoration? But if they're out of sight and out of mind, even if we grew up with them under the same roof, it will never happen. But maybe we stop by Mount Olive today for God to remind us that we're still connected to the young men and the young women and the older men and the older women who are part of the criminal justice system. Maybe we stop by for God to remind us that prison ministry is not outreach. Because I know the book of Acts says that you shall be witnesses unto me in Jerusalem and in Judea and in Samaria and under the uttermost parts of the earth. And most of us look at prison ministry as the uttermost parts of the earth. But if that's your son, that's not the uttermost parts of the earth. It's Jerusalem. And we have to reject the shame and reject the stigma and say, "That's still my son. That's still my grandson. That's still my daughter. That's still my mama. That's still my daddy." And even though they may have made a mistake, a terrible mistake, the fact of the matter is that God has not given up on them. In fact, King David says to this man from Lodibar who's made a mess of his life, "You've got a seat at the table." Guess who's coming to dinner? I'd love it if Obama came to my house for dinner. I'd be so excited. I would love to have dinner with President Obama. I wish I could have Martin Luther King come by my house for dinner. I would love to talk with him about the march on Washington and the march on Montgomery. There are all kinds of folk I'd love to have at my table. I'm from Philly. I'm a big basketball fan, and I would love to have Wilt Chamberlain come over to my house and talk with me about basketball and what it's like to score 100 points in one game on March 2nd, 1962 against the New York Knicks. I would love... There's so many people I would love to have come sit at my table, but that's because I'm starstruck. That's because I'm in the personality and in the celebrity. I hear God saying, my table doesn't work that way. And yes, I've got Martin Luther King at the table. And yes, one day the president will be at my table. And yes, all these famous folk are going to be at my table. But when they crown Jesus as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, there are going to be some ex-prisoners at my table. When they crown him King of Kings and Lord of Lords, there are going to be some folks with some sordid past at the table. When they crown him King of Kings and Lord of Lords. There are going to be some former murderers, some former adulterers, some former thieves at the table. When they crown him King of Kings and Lord of Lords, there are going to be some folks with a violent past at the table. But because I did not forget about them, because I did not give up on them, because I still walked with them and talked with them and told them that they were my own, because I did not pull the plug on them, because I kept ministering to them, because I kept watching them, the day came when they got a seat at the table. I'm glad I've got a seat at the table today. I wasn't born holy. I wasn't born perfect. I still remember my inmate number. I've got a testimony just like you, because I was sinking deep in sin, far from the peaceful shore, very deeply stained within, seeking to rise no more. But the master of the sea, he heard my despairing cry from the waters, from the prisons, from the jail cell, from solitary confinement, from trial, sentencing, and arrangement, lifted me now safe. Am I? Why did he do it? Not by education. Why did he do it? Not my family background. He did it because of love. Love lifted me. Love lifted me when nothing else would help. Love lifted me. Did he lift you one day? Did he lift your burdens? Did he lift your sins? Did he pick you up, turn you around, plant your feet on solid ground? Love lifted me. And because he lifted me, and because he lifted you, the folks that look at you funny and the folks that look at prisoners funny, God looks at them and says, guess who's coming to dinner?